From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Okay, here's the deal. Brooke Gladstone took a bit sick this week after she finished her interviews, but before she recorded her introduction, so I'll handle that for her. Just imagine me as a stunning brunette. And here we go. So, it turns out that the $700 billion congressional bank bailout that made headlines back in September doesn't begin to encompass the amount of taxpayer money the Federal Reserve has really been loaning to banks. See, there's this other $2 trillion. That's what Bloomberg News reported this week. But we don't know much about those deals, and we're supposed to. After all, here's Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson back in September.
We need oversight. We need protection. We need transparency. I want it. We all want it.
But apparently, the Fed doesn't want it, fearing, we suppose, that if we were aware of which banks were getting the money or what they were putting up as collateral for it, we would get nervous about them. On Wednesday, at least five Republican members of Congress called for the Fed to disclose which financial institutions are borrowing taxpayer money and what troubled assets the Fed is accepting as collateral. Bloomberg News has gone a step further and is suing the Fed under the Freedom of Information Act. Bloomberg News editor-in-chief Matt Winkler says, despite following the story for more than a year, they haven't been able to learn some of the most basic facts about this $2 trillion.
We have no idea what the collateral is, and we don't know who is receiving these loans. You know, when the Federal Reserve was conceived in the early part of the 20th century, the subject of the Fed's monetary activities wasn't a mystery. What is different now is that for the first time, and really this is unprecedented, the Fed is now accepting all kinds of troubled assets. And so we just think it's appropriate for the American taxpayer to know, well, what is this collateral that the Fed is now putting on its balance sheet on behalf, if you will, of the American taxpayer?
And basically what they're telling Congress and the rest of us is, don't worry, we have collateral, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. So it could be a $30 million home or it could be an old sneaker.
That's absolutely right. And the reason why this is such an important issue is because there actually are a lot of people in the marketplace right now who say that the market is going to continue to be troubled as long as the Treasury and the Fed maintain, if you will, this opaque wall between what the Fed and the Treasury are doing and the market.
Why would the opaque wall, I mean, I'm against it, I suppose, on principle, but why would that lead to a continuation of our time of troubles?
Well, we'd all like to know what the truth is. What is the value of these assets? If the Fed is taking them on its balance sheet, that means the Fed is buying and selling assets from these troubled financial institutions to help them so that they can lend money as they used to lend money in a normal way. The marketplace would benefit from knowing what those values are. And as soon as the marketplace does know, well, that's going to help the market begin recovery. It's kind of like once you know what the disease is, then it's a lot easier to begin thinking about, well, what should the cure be?
I was surprised when I read in one of Bloomberg's stories, Barney Frank seemed to agree with one financial expert saying, and I have the quote here, you have to balance the need for transparency with protecting the public interest. Taxpayers have a right to know where their tax dollars are going, but one piece of information standing alone could undermine public confidence in the system. Do you think that this notion that this kind of information could harm the economic recovery by instilling more fear holds water?
Well, that's one interpretation, but who should make that judgment? There are plenty of professionals in the credit markets whose living depends on managing debt securities. Their argument is the market will continue to be dysfunctional as long as the troubled assets that the Fed is buying and selling remain opaque. That's just a pretty sensible explanation why the Fed should take the step of disclosing this and let us, being everybody, figure out how to deal with reality. That's one argument. The second argument, of course, is it's everybody's money who is an American citizen, and therefore they are entitled to know this.
I wonder, do you think there's too much focus on the $700 billion? That number's imprinted on our brains, whereas really the amount of taxpayer money being loaned out is almost three times that amount.
I do think it's important that we keep in focus the biggest number, because that puts it in perspective, the magnitude, if you will, of the credit calamity we're in. And just 2 years ago, if I told you that the Federal Reserve would have loaned $2 trillion to a variety of financial institutions, and you don't know which institutions they are, and it's because they're all in trouble, you would have probably suggested that I was speaking about another country and maybe on another planet.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matt Winkler is the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News. We asked the Federal Reserve Board for a comment. A spokesman declined, saying they couldn't discuss ongoing litigation.
Just 1 week after a huge battle for same-sex marriage was lost in California, another is won.
Well, tonight, Connecticut becomes the second state in the country to recognize same-sex marriage.
Opponents are jubilant, opponents very angry.
They don't call them the culture wars for nothing. There is hardly a more contentious issue in today's politics than gay marriage, a showdown between those who consider it a question of basic civil rights and those who see it as an assault on moral values and the so-called traditional marriage. But as part of our occasional series, Word Watch, we wondered whether the conflict is ultimately less political than semantic. What if there were a clear distinction between the religious and cultural institution of marriage and the legal relationship between a couple and the state? You could have a church wedding or a secular one, but heterosexual or gay, the official certification would be for a civil union. In short, the government would divorce itself from the word marriage. Problem solved. Well, not so fast. We spoke with E.J. Graff, author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution. Though she's an ardent opponent of California Prop 8, she could scarcely even acknowledge the premise. Graff believes that people will never let go of the word marriage, even though its meaning has changed again and again over the centuries. 500 years ago, for instance.
Master needed a mistress. He could not move up from journeyman unless he had a wife to help oversee the apprentices and keep the shop clean and take the goods to market and probably keep the books. There's a traditional saying in English lore, he who marries for love has good nights and sorry days.
What about the Christian tradition of marriage? Is it not more or less a continuous line over 2,000 years?
Early Christianity rejected marriage very firmly. Their radical innovation in marriage was to say that people should be free to be celibate, to reject marriage even when arranged by their parents. As the centuries went on and Christianity became a ruling religion, it starts needing to deal with people as they are instead of as they ought to be. And for good 500 years, it starts fighting with the feudal lords and the various local cultural traditions. Christianity didn't really consolidate its hold over marriage and set its rules firmly into place until the year roughly 1200, 1215. I'm sorry, I'm a little fuzzy on the exact date. But it absolutely firmly entrenches the idea that you can only marry once and you have to marry for life. That was pretty hard fought.
It's clear that the traditions of so-called traditional marriage have evolved quite a bit over the centuries. But is it not possible that the world has kind of come to a conclusion about what marriage is?
I can't stress this enough. It's always being fought over, and exactly what the rules are and exactly what the meaning is, exactly who belongs in, exactly who belongs out, that is always getting fought over. So you have, for a good 1,000 years, the church fighting to own marriage, and it owns it for about 300 years, and its rules cause a lot of mess all over Europe. Then the Protestant Reformation comes in with the rise of the city-states and starts to say, this is all a mess, we're changing the rules. Then with the new rise of industrial capitalism between 1850 and 1950, as people start making their individual livings, then we get yet another revolution in marriage. And those battles are all over what is the ruling idea of marriage. Are you marrying for love? Are you marrying for money? Are you marrying for procreation? And as we start to decide that marriage is about two equal partners who care for each other. Each one can work. Each one can own his or her own property. Each one is an equal partner in the rearing of the children. Same-sex couples are following rather than leading the radical transformation of marriage over the past 150 years.
What if when the first time governments did get involved, they had not embraced the word marriage but used, you know, something more bureaucratic and emotion neutral? Do you think we'd be in the same fix today?
They wouldn't have won. People would have continued to get married in their traditional ways. The state's power grab, the attempt to own the word marriage, only worked because they used the word marriage.
But once the state got involved and used the word marriage to describe the legally binding contract with the state, isn't that where all the problems began? Had states started using the term civil union X hundred number of years ago, would we even be having this conversation today?
The United States is somewhat unusual in allowing religious people to perform civil marriages. In France, for instance, you're allowed to have a religious ceremony afterwards, but if you want a civilly recognized marriage, you have to go first to City Hall. But the word marriage is the constant. If you are married to a woman and you and she go to Albania, one of you has a heart attack and the other wants to see the person in the emergency room, and you say, "We are married," they're going to treat you as married in Albania under their laws and customs, no matter how different those laws and customs might be here in the United States. Marriage is the passport word. The word marriage is the one people get in their gut. That has the emotional meaning to them. It's already there. Just change the rules like we always have.
EJ, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
EJ Graff is a resident scholar at the Brandeis Women's Studies Research Center and author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution. Coming up, the American car is part of the American brand. So what does it mean when the big three become three stooges? This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. With sales at a standstill, their stock prices plummeting, and their cash reserves dwindling, the big three auto companies didn't much like the news they got Thursday. According to the Democratic leadership in the Senate, votes for a federal bailout are just not there. The automakers say the ripple effect of bankruptcies would devastate every level of the economy. But others argue that bankruptcy could force them to regroup and reemerge as leaner and more competitive. But never mind economic catastrophe, what about our feelings? GM, Ford, and Chrysler and the cars they build are so iconic, so much a part of the American culture, so much a part of the American psyche. Wouldn't their collapse bury a portion of our very souls? Sharon Carty covers the auto industry for USA Today. She recalls interviewing a man a few years back who said he drove only American cars. Then she asked him what that means.
And he said that it had to be built in America by an American company, by American workers. And so I asked him what car he drove, and he said he drove a Buick Century. And the look on his face when I told him it was built in Canada, he just was devastated. And he said, well, you know, it doesn't matter. They're American cars.
Whereas his Toyota Camry could have been built in Tennessee or something.
Exactly. We're building cars in Mexico. We're building cars in Canada. And we're calling them American. And meanwhile, these Japanese companies are coming here and they're building cars here. So, you know, what does it mean to be an American car? I'm not quite sure.
Now, there was a time when American cars were so much a part of our culture and our lives that they kind of emerged organically in popular culture, like the Mustang that Steve McQueen drove in Bullet, like the cars in American Graffiti, the Camaro that the A-Team drove. But now the domestic manufacturers have been reduced to trying to force their products into the popular culture. Can you tell me how they're doing that?
Ford has an office out in Hollywood where they spend a lot of time getting their cars into movies. And they were recently won the 2008 Brand Cameo Award for overall product placement. They had cars in 30 of the 52 number one movies in 2007. So this is a big effort of theirs to make sure that they've got cars in those race scenes that you see. They particularly like to have cars in spy movies or cop movies or CSI. Most recent example is the Bond movie, the Quantum Solace, that came out this week, where Ford has the European car, the Ford Ka, in there. Saturn has an agreement with Project Runway, so all of the Project Runway contestants win a Saturn, and you always see them driving around in Saturns and talking about their Saturn. Top Chef is sponsored by Toyota, so whenever they go anywhere, they're all in Toyotas. So it's something that the automakers really spend a lot of time and effort on because they just want their cars to be associated with what's hip and what's cool.
Does all that product placement actually work? Do people have the same visceral reaction to a clearly product-placed Ford, say, in 24 or in a Batman movie, that they would have to seeing the Mustang that was so much a central part of Bullitt?
I'm not sure that the product placement really works in that way that people sort of get viscerally attached to it. It keeps the cars in people's consciousness, so they're thinking about it. I think what's more natural and organic is when people start picking up the names of cars and sticking them into songs. When Cadillac started first hitting its revival at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, I think Cadillac was kind of taken by surprise that all of these hip-hop artists started talking about riding in their caddies. And that is more natural. That's happening because people are interested in it and it's resonating with them. And then you see it sort of bubble up through songs. I don't think you can product place into songs as much as you can into movies. And so when you see it happening in music, it seems like it's actually reflecting some level of a success rather than some successful use of your checkbook to get your car in the movie.
You know, cars ultimately are a consumer product, but there's so much more than that. Our relationship with our cars so far is a lot more intimate than the one with our microwave ovens, for example. Can you discuss why that is?
People see you driving around in your car just like they see you wearing your clothes. And what they choose to drive tends to reflect a little bit about what they value. So you could say that maybe folks who drive maybe more of an econo box or saying to the world that they're sort of counterculture because they're just driving something that's cheap and affordable, just like you would just sort of wear jeans and a t-shirt and say that you don't really care about what everybody else cares about. And if you're driving a Hummer, you're probably telling people that you've got more money than God and you can just light it on fire in the evening if you want.
Okay, so what happens if these brands fail? What does that do to the collective consciousness, to our national psyche? Will we still be singing about a brand in bankruptcy?
I'm not sure about that. What a lot of people sort of underestimate, the impact that the ability to make things has on people. Back in World War II, a lot of the car plants around here stopped making cars and started making bombers just to help out the war effort. We're Americans. We can do things. We can make things. So I'm not sure if we have an industry that's failed and in bankruptcy, if it's going to really hurt the way we think about ourselves and think about our country. If we're a country based on retail and banking and services, do they still feel that same level of pride that you did back in the World War II, saying that we could do this, we can pull it together? Or is our only self-identity right now that, like, we can shop through this?
Sharon, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Sharon Carty covers the automotive industry for USA Today.
Take me riding in the car, car. Take me riding in the car, car. Take you riding in the car, car.
If the car has a special place in the American psyche, then car critics are the vehicle, which drives, that particular narrative. True, car critics tend to be regarded with a certain suspicion in the journalism business, since most newspapers depend on the goodwill of car dealership advertisers. But Dan Neal is the Oscar Wilde of auto reviewers. We spoke to him back in 2004, just after he won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. In his Los Angeles Times column, cars serve ably as metaphors for our culture. To wit,
why do I like the Benz wagon? For me, whose personal life has often resembled the Save My Baby skit with the clown fireman, the station wagon connotes a settled domesticity, peace, and stability, devoutly to be wished. Singledom has certainly lost its luster. There's also something deeply appropriate about wagons. They are big enough to enclose my life, but not so big as to suggest a fear of something left behind, as huge SUVs seem to do. Station wagons are kind of like SUVs after years of therapy. So I find myself doing is kind of identifying not so much the mechanical deficiencies and surpluses of a particular car, but how it fits into people's lives, what it says about them, and whether it says something you would like it to say about you. For instance, this week I'm driving a Chevy SSR pickup. It's kind of a postmodern hot rod pickup truck. It's like a pickup truck from Toontown. I mean, you feel ridiculous driving it. So I feel that it's one of those vehicles that you would drive once, park, and sell.
Now, as you just described, you seem to love cars, but individual cars can frequently leave you cold. And that's difficult, many people say, for car critics, because auto advertising is so important. And, of course, there's a story floating around about you. Could you tell us about the last column you wrote for the Raleigh News and Observer back in 1997?
Sure. I actually worked in classified advertising when I was working for the News Observer, and I produced an advertorial auto section, and I wrote the column for them. I didn't ask anybody, and nobody read it behind me. It just appeared in the paper. You know, my column was really crazy, and this one time I wrote a story about having intimate Congress in the back of Ford Expedition. I said at the time, you know, we both had our seatbelts on. It was safe sex. And actually, they didn't think it was that funny at all. So my boss called me in and said, okay, that's it. You are on super, super double Dutch probation. Basically, he was saying to me that I was going to have to be vetted by the advertising boss. And this I declined to do. And so after a few months of passive resistance, they fired me. And by the way, the News and Observer, on the other side of the church-state wall, the news side, is a very, very honorable and respectable, you know, operation. At issue, though, is whether or not newspapers who produce these advertorial sections, you know, whether their hands are clean on this issue overall.
We spoke to Keith Bradshaw, who's the author of the book High and Mighty about SUVs, mm-hmm. and he says that among critics, auto reviewers are the most likely to be compromised by the industry they cover, that they're often quitting their jobs to take industry PR jobs for big bucks. Do you think that's true, and did that ever tempt you?
It is absolutely true. The entire environment is incestuous. They introduce new cars. They fly journalists in and put them up at really nice hotels and, you know, treat them to experiences that they could never possibly in a million years. They wouldn't even be allowed in these hotels ordinarily. You know, then they let them drive the cars and then they go away, you know, and that's not supposed to affect their judgment. What's surprising is not that it does affect their judgment, but that so often it doesn't affect their judgment. I forget who said it, but some politician said, if you can't take their money and vote against them anyway, you're no damn good. but it is a compromised business, and it is also true that newspapers are under a great deal of revenue pressure on this score. And so, yeah, a favorable editorial/advertorial content is often created to satisfy that need.
Which you frequently don't provide.
Almost never. I'm really ornery.
Does the industry hate you?
No. No, the manufacturers are tremendous about this. You know, like General Motors, right? You know, this thing that I'm driving that's just an awful vehicle, this SSR. They know that, you know, I may hate that vehicle, but I may like something else. And I think it's worth it to them.
Dan Neal is automobile critic for the Los Angeles Times and recipient of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. We recorded that conversation 4 years ago. And now for our wrap-up of fake news headlines. On Wednesday, New York Times readers were greeted with the headline, Iraq War Ends, among other improbable stories, thanks to a group of left-wing pranksters who distributed copies around New York City and put up a fake Times website. More screed than parody, the phony Great Gray Lady imagined such events as a Bush treason trial with all the wit and subtlety of a whoopee cushion. And then there was this.
Who did tell Fox News that Palin could not identify the countries involved in NAFTA and that she thought Africa was a country instead of a continent? Turns out it was Martin Eisenstadt, a McCain policy advisor, who has come forward today to identify himself as the source of the leaks.
That was MSNBC's David Schuster, first on cable news to reveal the previously anonymous source on Fox News's tantalizing Sarah Palin scoop. Only problem was, the supposed source was an internet prankster too, as Schuster could have discovered in 20 seconds with a Google search. The blogosphere was quick to jump on this hoax as the latest proof of mainstream media's irrelevancy. But if you, as I do, keep your finger constantly on the pulse of Mrs. Garfield, you'd have to consider another interpretation. Garfield, she argued. What it is proof of is you can't trust the internet. MSNBC made a mistake, but we need the authority and accountability of real news organizations. Otherwise, how do we know what is real and what is invented? Is what she said, and it's a fair question. But what about when the authoritative, accountable news organization itself perpetrates the hoax? Fake news, it turns out, has a long tradition, as we discussed about a year and a half back with the Columbia Journalism Review's Robert Love.
Hoaxes became part of newspaper dumb's menu of entertainment. Nobody really thought the worst of the papers for doing it. In some cases, they would reveal at the last line that this was all made up. Sometimes it would took place on, you know, April 1st. But many times, it never did.
What about the much vaunted relationship of trust between reporters and readers? Did that not matter back then?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question to answer. But the truth is that sometime after the first couple of decades of the 20th century, newspapers began to acquire the mantle of authority, almost a quasi-governmental source of truth about what was going on. To a large part, that didn't exist for many papers in the mid 19th century. There was news. It was often biased. It was often kind of like some of the news you get today in certain outlets that have a kind of slant to them one way or the other. And people understood that.
Tell me about the Central Park Zoo hoax in the New York Herald in the 1870s.
The Central Park Zoo hoax is one of the most famous hoaxes in the great landscape of media hoaxes. And there's a rumor that the publisher said he could keep every New Yorker indoors just by publishing a story like this one day. And somebody said, I'll take you up on that bet. But what happened was, on November 9th, 1874, the Herald talked about a Central Park Zoo escape. There was a lion seen inside a church. A rhinoceros had fallen into the river. The National Guard was called out, and I believe it was 27 people were already dead and hundreds injured. The paper called it a, quote, bloody and fearful carnival, and that the animals were still on the loose. People started reading this article, and they just set out to defend themselves, their homes, and their families. But at the very end of it, it said, the entire story given above is pure fabrication.
Sounds like a million laughs.
So, and the point of it was, if a hoax needs a higher moral point, it was that the conditions of the animals at the zoo and their cages was thought to be not up to snuff by these crusading reporters.
What's the deal with all the hoaxes in New York City? Is it just that that's where some of the biggest papers were, or is there something about the nature of this city that lends itself to it?
Well, more papers, I think. Brooke, also, we have better records of the old newspapers in New York than we do elsewhere. There were thousands of hoaxes that are unrecorded in small newspapers throughout the West, especially in the 19th century. Many of them were about finding the remains of a petrified man. This was a hoax that became such a cliche that Mark Twain himself set out to shatter it by writing the best petrified man story he could.
A hardy perennial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of history's most peculiar and most persistent hoaxes, you note in your story, was by H.L. Mencken, but not in Baltimore, where he was most famous for working. It was in the New York Evening Mail in 1917, and it was headlined, A Neglected Anniversary.
Mencken's Neglected Anniversary was the natural history of the plumbed bathtub in America. It was so well constructed, so well written, that it was quoted in sources high and low from then on. It stated that a man named Adam Thompson had become acquainted with the tub in Europe and had brought one here, and it had been basically roundly poo-pooed by Americans. But finally, President Millard Fillmore, going against the political grain, bravely ordered one put into the White House, and from then on, the bathtub was an American institution. Of course, all of this is completely made up.
He claimed that the city of Boston made it illegal to bathe except, quote, under medical advice. He said that here the bathtub was denounced as an Epicurean and obnoxious toy from England designed to corrupt the democratic simplicity of the republic.
Well, it's interesting that recent surveys have found out that too much use of a bathtub can do all those things and more.
Weaken the simplicity of the republic?
Kidding.
You know, we did some digging and found that President Truman, in a 1952 speech in Philadelphia at the American Hospital Association convention, repeated parts of Mencken's story as fact.
The local medical association in Cincinnati, Ohio, passed resolutions calling Mrs. Fillmore an indecent person because she had put a bathtub in the White House. This medical association in Cincinnati said that it was unsanitary, that it was unhealthy, that no person should take all his clothes off at one time.
That sounds right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Robert Love teaches at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. He talked to us about hoaxes in 2007. Coming up, the pioneering publisher of great literature that happens to be dirty. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Supreme Court announced it would not hear cases about the use of victim impact statements, testimony given in the criminal sentencing process to demonstrate the human toll of a crime. One of the cases involved Douglas Oliver Kelly, a man who was convicted of a 1993 first-degree murder and rape and was put on death row in California. Before the jury considered whether or not to sentence Kelly to death, they watched a 20-minute video montage narrated by the mother of the 19-year-old murder victim, Sarah Weir. The montage is made up of still photographs and home video clips that follows Sarah from her birth.
Sarah was born on May 7, 1974, in Calgary, Alberta. Most of these pictures were taken during July and August of that year.
To the time of her death.
As time goes by, I try very hard not to think of Sarah in terms of this terrible crime.
You may have noticed the background music. That's Enya, the lushly orchestrated, vaguely New Agey Irish vocalist, whose performance actually became an issue in the case. Evan Young, the public defender who handled Kelly's appeal, argued that using Enya made the testimony unduly prejudicial.
Unduly prejudicial means that the excessive emotion of the evidence overwhelms the possibility that a decision by a jury could be reliable, accurate, not arbitrary.
Now, you could argue that victim impact statements in and of themselves are prejudicial because they're designed, in fact, to generate emotion among a jury. But the Supreme Court has ruled, no, victim impact statements, they're okay.
The theory behind them did not have to do with emotion. It had to do with allowing the state the same ability that a defendant had, which in a capital case, a defendant is allowed to put on evidence to show his or her life, you know, what happened to him or her growing up. And the court wanted to balance that. While the court acknowledged that this kind of evidence could be emotional, they also put in the idea that if it became too emotional and so infected the process that it rendered it fundamentally unfair, then that would cross the line and violate due process.
But you're saying at some point it really gets ridiculous.
Well, that's right. I mean, when you start talking about introducing videotapes, films, especially ones set to music, I mean, there really is no other reason other than to play to someone's emotion.
In fact, in your petition to the court, you used a quotation of the American composer Aaron Copland. about the power of music, not only to soothe the savage breast, but to get it agitated.
He was discussing his score for the film Of Mice and Men, and he said that the score is designed to strengthen and underline the emotional content of the entire picture. And then he went on to say that the quickest way to a person's brain is through his eye, but even in the movies, the quickest way to his heart and feelings is still through the ear.
Now, what is, to my way of thinking, just truly bizarre about this case is that the California Supreme Court, whose decision you were appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, the ruling was that some music was clearly too emotional, but others was just fine. They drew a distinction between Enya and, for example, James Taylor. What was that all about?
Well, you have the California Supreme Court trying to be music critics. They say that the music of Enya was generally soft, not stirring. And I don't know whether they're trying to make the distinction between the volume at which it was played or the emotion that it is supposed to inspire, but it seems like a difficult distinction to make.
Yeah, although, you know, you said that it puts judges and justices in the position of being music critics, but it sounds more like it puts them in the position of being, I don't know, psychoneurologists, determining at what point people's emotions are affected by a certain vocalist.
Well, exactly, and there's simply no way to know that. And, you know, as I pointed out in my brief, you would never allow a witness to testify in court accompanied by some sort of music. It just doesn't make any sense.
And in fact, it is unquestionably absurd to imagine it, and yet the victim's statement is testimony. But the Supreme Court says, no, they're down with that. So what's your next move?
Just to keep on presenting this argument to the trial court and the appellate court and hope that the issue makes its way back to the Supreme Court in a case in which they find it worthy of another look. I think that they are going to have to address this situation in the near future. As I pointed out in my brief, the cases in California are coming fast and furious, and the videotapes themselves are becoming much more sophisticated.
Should you ever get to appear before the Supreme Court, as you make your oral arguments, who do you have as your music track?
Oh, James Taylor, absolutely.
Evan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Evan Young is a senior deputy state public defender in the city of San Francisco.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song.
In 1951, Grove Press was a tiny, almost defunct independent publisher with just three titles in its catalog, including Herman Melville's The Confidence Man. But then Barney Rossett took over and, with a few choice books, helped push America past its puritanical roots and into the sexual revolution. Rossett was a native Chicagoan who settled in New York after returning from the war. Almost immediately, he began publishing controversial authors as Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, and explicit works of erotica like Story of O. It wasn't long before Rossett and Grove Press found themselves defending the First Amendment in the courts.
When we published Lady Chatterley's Lover, it was denounced as a wicked, perverse, terrible, degrading work, etc., etc. Then when we published Tropic of Cancer, we were told that Lady Chatterley's Lover was a fine book of creative merit, but that with Tropic of Cancer we had gone beyond the bounds of decency, that it was a corrupt, perverse mess. And now, with Naked Lunch, we go to court and are told that Tropic of Cancer is a brilliant work of great merit, a modern classic, etc., etc. It is only Naked Lunch that is a bad book. Somehow, I imagine the day when Naked Lunch will be the modern classic and it will be yet something else which will be beyond the bounds of decency.
If Tropic of Cancer proved to be Grove Press's most hard-won case, Barney Rossett was happy to fight the fight. The book, heard here in a reading by Henry Miller himself, was his favorite.
This, then, this is not a book. This is libel, slander, defamation of character. This is not a book in the ordinary sense of the word. No, this is a prolonged insult a gob of spit in the face of art, a kick in the pants to God, man, destiny, time, love, beauty, what you will.
Rossett championed the works of Miller and other ostensibly lewd authors for more than 50 years, and now the literary establishment is returning the favor. On Wednesday, Rossett will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Foundation for, quote, his vision and enormous contributions to American publishing. He's also the subject of a new documentary called Obscene. Brooke recently sat with Rossett at his home in Greenwich Village, where he talked about some of the most memorable books he acquired in those first years of Grove Press.
One of the first and the most important book we were ever to publish was Waiting for Godot of Samuel Beckett.
What was it that intrigued you about Beckett?
That he was a great writer. I was absolutely astounded and taken over by his work. Financially, it was hardly a big thing. We paid $200 advance for Waiting for Godot. We had also taken on Jean Genet, I think a very important writer and playwright. And soon thereafter, Ionesco was added, making a third. So you could say that the first group of writers contained a disproportionate percentage of playwrights, but that was not on purpose.
The first book that you chose to fight in the courts to publish was Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. Why did you want to publish it?
The book I was going to publish and did eventually was Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer. I had read that at Swarthmore College in 1940, freshman English course. I liked it very much. And so when I found myself publishing books, the first thing I thought of was Tropic of Cancer. But I knew enough by then to know that it would be censored or it would be stopped. And I decided to very carefully prepare a campaign to protect it. Lady Chatterley's Lover was probably the most famous so-called obscene book, and it was by a famous English author, very much looked up to in the literary world. So I decided to publish Lady Chatterley's Lover in its entirety, and if any troubles came along, which they most certainly did, we would fight those through, and when we won them, we would then follow up with Tropic of Cancer.
This was part, I guess, of a long strategy. The Postal Service actually confiscated copies of Lady Chatterley's Lover that were sent through the mail. You told the Postal Service that they were coming, right? And then you sued the New York City postmaster?
That's right. I had somebody who had worked as an intern for me here in New York and who now lived in Paris send copies of the book very comically, really. They didn't stop them. They kept coming through. I had to tell them, hey, you're letting something illegal through. Finally, they did seize the book, and then we formed a case to get the charges dropped.
And ultimately, you did win that case. You were allowed to bring out Lady Chatterley's Lover, and that set the stage for Tropic of Cancer, right?
That's right. And it took quite a while.
Tell me what it was that you loved about Tropic of Cancer.
It was a very cynical, tough book about the United States. Henry was living in France until he was forced to leave by the World War II, and he had a very strong, sometimes contemptuous stance towards this country. He felt that people had very little originality here. There was very little real feeling. Also, something that was very important in it, and also in Beckett, there was a lost love. Miller had a long, ongoing love affair with a girl who left him, and he had to make a way to live, to go on living, and he did. And there's a similar incident in Beckett, Krapp's Last Tape. And I had the same not unusual experience, and it was a matter of how do you continue living. And through both of them, I thought I got strength.
What can you tell me about the court battle over Tropic of Cancer?
The court battles were certainly beyond what we imagined. they started immediately upon our publishing the book. We have a feeling, and pretty good proof, that a whole group of police got together, picked on one page, so happened to be page 5 of the book, to use as an example for other police to seize copies of the book, read page 5, and arrest the book sales people. And that happened all over the United States, from one city to another, to another, to another. And we had to go and fight in each place, dozens and dozens of places. It took a number of years, really, as we gradually worked our way up the American jurisprudence system to get to the Supreme Court. But we made it.
Of course, you didn't just publish so-called obscene books. You also took on material that was controversial in the racially charged atmosphere of the 60s. How did you come to publish the autobiography of Malcolm X?
Well, the autobiography of Malcolm X sort of fell upon us. When he was assassinated, there was a statement that the publisher here was not going to go ahead with publishing the book because it would be a danger to his employees, that they might be physically attacked. I didn't feel that way, and I bought the rights to the book.
We saw the documentary that recently came out about you called Obscene. What did you think about it?
I think a good idea of the difference between my viewpoint and the viewpoint of the producer of the film was that he chose to call it obscene, and my autobiography, which I've been writing for quite a while and which parallels that film, I call The Subject is Left-Handed. Slight difference there.
What does that mean, the subject is left-handed?
The FBI, CIA, and others did many, many reports on me, which I was able to get from the Freedom of Information Act, thousands of documents. And the heading was used a number of times, the subject is left-handed. And I sympathize with them.
You just don't think you gave them enough material to go on, huh?
They have an enormous amount of material, but it added up to the subject is left-handed.
Did it bother you, all this attention on Grove Press as publishers of mere smut, when you believed you were publishing also very important works of literature? Or maybe these works of smut were, in fact, important works of literature?
Yeah, it did bother me. It did bother me, but what was I going to do about it?
You took on challenge after challenge with so much gusto. It does seem that you were on a First Amendment crusade. You were trying to break barriers. How does it seem to you?
I mean, to me, I was just doing what I would be doing. It's what came naturally. I read Tropic of Cancer when I was a freshman in college. It was not a great decision to publish it for me. It was how to do it and when.
Not whether.
I mean, Samuel Beckett showed more concern about being censored than Miller ever did. Miller showed no interest. Sam wrote me right after we signed the first contract that he wanted me to know that he wouldn't stand for any censorship of his material, which was censored. Godot was censored in England.
Why was it censored in England?
I remember one little sequence where one of the two says to the other, if one of us hangs himself.
Well, what do we do now?
Wait.
Yes, but while waiting.
How about hanging ourselves?
It might give us an erection.
An erection?
With all that follows. Where it falls, mandrakes grow. That's why they shriek when you pull them up. Did you not know that?
Let's hang ourselves immediately.
I didn't seriously listen to anybody who said books were smut or this or that. It didn't mean much to me. I mean, come on. I'm an anti-fascist. I'm a communist. I'm not bothered by smut peddling accusations. I said I'm a communist. I'm not. I was. I was a member of the Communist Party. The Communist Party was more against sex and books than any other group I've ever met. When that fact fully sunk in on me, which took quite a while, I quit.
Barney Rossett is currently editor-in-chief of the online publication The Evergreen Review. On Wednesday, he will receive the National Book Foundation's Literarian Award for outstanding service to the American literary community. That's it for this week's show. On the Media, it was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and Michael Bernstein, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Pritchep and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be totally here next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.